Plot twists. We are obsessed with them. In film, life, and love, they turn up everywhere. It's that moment in a story that takes you in an unexpected direction. I'm Tom, super fan of cinema, sport, comedy, and I'm partial to the odd impression. And throughout this series, brought to you by Now and Sky, I'll be interviewing TV and film stars, asking them all about the plot twist moments that define their lives and careers. So expect the unexpected, and hopefully some behind-the-scenes gems you've never heard before. Expect spoilers. If I was to ask you, who's on your Mount Rushmore of comedy sitcom characters, who are we talking about? Dwight Schrute, US Office? Sheldon Cooper, Big Bang Theory? David Jason, got to be, Only Fools and Horses, certainly in the UK. But I bet my guest this week, Eric Stonestreet, who played Cam in Modern Family, he'd probably be in the conversation. He'd have to be. What an amazing role. What a character. What a show. The Tuckers, the Pritchards, just an all-time top comedy. And like his character Cam, Eric is a fun-loving personality, full of charisma. You may also recognise his voice from playing Duke in Secret Life of Pets, available on Now and Sky. It's a fun film with Easter coming up. And away from acting, Eric is, well, he was up until recently, the biggest fan of the Kansas City Chiefs. Somebody called Taylor Swift apparently is a fan now. I don't know. But he is a super fan of the Chiefs. And we actually spoke just before the Super Bowl, which the Chiefs were playing in. So that felt like a good place to start. And I may have had some memorabilia to show some allegiance, to warm his heart, typical Tom fashion. And actually, there is a lot of pride and identity with Kansas City for Eric. It's where he was born and raised. A lot of his experiences growing up and living in Kansas made their way to Hollywood. I hope you enjoy this one. Eric Stonestreet on Plot Twist. Eric, it's a pleasure having you on Plot Twist. But before we start, I feel kind of rude because I've got my hat here and you've obviously got your hat on. I just thought maybe if I put this on,
this would...
Yeah. Nice. Oh, and there's one more thing too. Hang on. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Well,
I got a lot of Chief stuff around me.
But this is a big weekend for you.
Yes, it is. Tomorrow's a big day, but we're used to big days in this era of Kansas City Chiefs football. Did you become a fan from when we came over there a couple years ago?
I've been a sort of a loose fan of the NFL. I'm more an NBA guy, but you know, obviously I know who I'm talking to. You know, the biggest fan of the Chiefs. So I've got to pay my respects here.
Yeah, that's very, very nice of you. I'm only wearing a hat because my hair is completely out of control right now. It's so long, but I mean, you don't have to keep yours on if you don't want to. You have nice hair.
I just thought you might, I don't know, it might put you at ease. You know, might buy some affection here. So, you know, it might work in my favor. It's a big weekend for you. You brace for tomorrow. Are you feeling confident? What's the vibe?
Well, I'm always feeling confident with Patrick Mahomes as our quarterback and Andy Reid as our coach. But Baltimore's going to be a tough team, no doubt about it. I don't know when people will be hearing this, but it will probably be after we win or lose. So I'm going to do everything I can from the living room of my home in Kansas City and hope that that is enough. But let's just all be thankful that I'm not out on the field in any capacity playing and that the city of Kansas City isn't relying on me in any way to get the victory.
Firstly, I'd like to see you on the sidelines with Andy Reid. Randy Reid, you too.
Yeah.
You
know, that would be fun. I've never gotten to watch an NFL game from the sidelines. That's always been a dream of mine just to see. I've seen college football from the sidelines, but I've never been down on the sidelines for an NFL game.
Oh, it must be wild.
It's fast.
Because I remember in 2020, correct me if I'm wrong, you kind of lost your voice after the Super Bowl win because there was a lot of jubilation. There was a lot of antics.
Yeah, it was crazy. And we had a couple episodes of Modern Family to film still to finish the show. And I had to go back to Los Angeles and I had to go to a Bono's vocal doctor to get my vocal cords healed, which was quite a treat to get an injection. And I forget what they gave me, but I couldn't talk. I mean, my vocal cords were shot from going to the Super Bowl.
Oh, that's incredible. And obviously, fast forward a few years on, you might not be, I mean, in my heart you are, but you might not be the most famous Chiefs fan these days. Mm. There's somebody else who's come along on the sidelines. Are you a Swiftie? Are you a fan? Are you enjoying this kind of extra activity that's going on behind the scenes?
I love it. I now I'm getting to the point where I love how much other people hate it, you know, because we're a world filled with haters, right? Nobody can just have a good time and be themselves without somebody crapping on their parade. So I love Taylor for Travis. Travis has been a good, great guy for Kansas City. He's been a good, great guy for me personally and the charities that we do here in Kansas City. He's been nothing but ever sweet to my parents, my mom, my sister, Lindsay's boys when he sees them. So I know what a great guy he is, and I love it if he loves it. So that's about all I care about. And then with her coming to the game, she's a human being that's allowed to go out of her house and do things just like everybody else. So I'm happy that whatever course was set has brought her to Kansas City and to the Chiefs kingdom. I think it's great. And yeah, I mean, I never thought I'd really be listening to a lot of Taylor Swift songs. Not that, you know, I'm better than, or I just, the last Taylor Swift song I really paid attention to probably was when she was in country music. And then I've really gotten into it. Lindsay and went to see the concerts, and then she's got me listening to it. I love the "It's Not Me, It's You, I'm the Problem, It's Me." I love that song. Yeah. I think it's a great song. But anyway, happy she's around. Happy for Travis. Love it all. And I'm happy for her because she's got Travis, and, you know,
he's a great guy.
Maybe this is the one.
I mean, I know you're more a Trace Adkins kind of guy, but, you know, she's still great.
You liked all those goodbye songs videos I did at the end of Modern Family.
Yeah, it came on my song in my car the other day. The song came on, and my girlfriend was like, "What is this?" I was like, "Hey, this means something, okay? This is the end of Modern Family. This is a big deal.
Well,
you're gonna miss this."
People didn't realize it at the time, but I had a plan there, and it's exactly what you experienced in the car, which is I incepted the crew with a very visual. What's the version of that for audio?
Yeah, I'm trying. I know what you mean.
You know, an oral memory, a sense memory is what I incepted them with. We'll edit that part out. Couldn't think of a word. But I wanted everyone in the future, when they heard that song, and I knew they would, to go right back to that memory. We all do that with sounds and smells and visual aids, and it puts us in a time and a place. And I wanted that song for every crew member to, when they heard. And here's the good news. I get texts and emails all the time saying, "Drive it in my car and guess what comes on?" And they go right back to that moment. So I'm happy that worked.
It certainly did work. You've got a few of those, actually, that we'll probably talk about. I obviously started with the Chiefs, and you are Kansas City born and raised.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be nice to kind of talk about that and your experiences growing up. Because what I love is there is this sort of juxtaposition between that life and Hollywood. But actually, a lot of those experiences and the people that made you who you are have influenced those stories in Hollywood, obviously, in Modern Family. Talk to me about some of those sort of overriding memories. What comes to mind when you think of growing up in and around Kansas City?
Well, you know, I grew up sort of in the most rural part of Kansas City you could. And, you know, my dad, he had a retail business, and I think he kind of had an unfulfilled part of his life in which he wanted to work with animals probably when he was a kid, and life circumstances or whatever took him in another direction. But him having my brother and sister and I and living in a rural part of Kansas City gave us the opportunity to be in something called 4-H, which is an agricultural based, you know, community group clubs. There's different clubs with the fair. It feeds the fairs, the county fairs. And you have projects. And I had pigs, and my brother had cows, and my sister also did pigs with me. But before that, you know, my friends had started saying that they wanted to, you know, have little odds and end jobs, or their dads were paying them to do this or do that. And I said, well, I want to do that. And so one Saturday morning, my dad woke me up. We drove to Nebraska, and we picked up a bunch of pigs and came home and built a pen for him. And he said, there's your job. Now you have something to do every morning before school and after school. And from about the fourth grade on, I had usually around 60 or more pigs to take care of. Which was a real blessing for me, because I didn't realize it at the time, but what it taught me was that the world exists more than 3 feet around me, right? We're always pretty self-consumed about what our needs are. And at such a young age, I learned that I had to take care of something else. And in this case, it was 60 pigs.
I guess it gives you a bit of a work ethic as well, right?
Well, I think so. And more than anything there, and, you know, my dad was a very different kind of guy than I was, a lot of similarities, but he worked with his hands and he unloaded trucks and loaded trucks. And he had just this blue collar man's work ethic. And what him setting me up with that operation at such a young age taught me was that I did need to find something else to do with my life, because that wasn't my calling. And he always would laugh and say, "Eric, you could watch somebody work for days." You know, I would always try to find something else to do. And not that I didn't accomplish things, because I did. I put up hay from a young age, built fence, cleaned out barns, stalls, and I did have chores to do my whole life until I went off to college. But he taught me through that was that I needed to find a different calling that wasn't involving so much manual labor.
Well, when did that first become apparent that there might be, because you kind of, I wouldn't say you fell into acting, but wasn't it a bit of a dare that led to your first play? One of those sort of random situations where it was a bit of a bet, really.
School wasn't my thing.
Makes two of us.
Yeah, I never enjoyed it. And when I did, it was always because I had a great teacher. And I look back at my school days, and when I think about enjoying school, it was always because of a great teacher that made it interesting and made it fun. But school wasn't for me, but I didn't have a choice from my parents' perspective. They, you know, neither of them were college graduates, and they were going to make sure their kids were. And I appreciate that now, but they basically said, "No, you're going to college and you're going to find something that's interesting. You know, you don't worry about how you're going to make, you know, money in life. Go and have an interesting college experience." So thankful that was the approach to college, because that's exactly what it was. I tried to be in as many different things as I could, meet as many different people as I could, which eventually led me to the theater. My best friend, Paul, who is still my best friend, we met in our pledge fraternity class. He had done theater in high school. I had never. I had performed as a clown. I wanted to be a clown. I didn't have any play theater experience. And he was like, "You'd probably really like it." And so he dared me to audition. And I said I would if he would. And we both traipsed up to the theater department at Kansas State and auditioned for a play. And I got cast as a small part in the...
Prelude to a Kiss?
Yeah, Prelude to a Kiss. And he got cast as Bernardo in Hamlet, and off we went. That was the beginning for me. And I just had no idea that that's where college would take me. I was going to college, and in my dad's advice, I had found the lane of prison administrator. Yes, that's right. Prison administrator as what sounded interesting to me, because prisons were sort of the backdrop of where I grew up and where I lived in Leavenworth, Kansas. It's a famous prison town. You hear it referenced a lot in movies. And I was always fascinated by it. It's like what you can't see. And when I found out you could go to college and get a degree in something that would take me in there for the right reasons, I was like, well, yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll be a prison administrator.
It's quite a contrast. Was it instantaneous when you do the play? Like the, because I had a lot of people on, they talk about the reaction, that first relationship with the audience, and they're like, this is it. Were you sold from the off, or was it a bit of a builder?
You know, I don't have a specific memory of that. Getting back to, I was sold on performance before that play, and that's the clowning stuff. And through 4-H, you know, there was always a something that I could do performance-wise through 4-H, whether it was a talent show or getting up and giving speeches at our meetings or whatever. So I had been touched by the addiction of approval, of an audience approval, long before that. You know, I was performing when I was a little kid, you know, and I'm always interested in hearing from my mom and other relatives of when they noticed that I was kind of had a performance penchant for performance and that audience approval that you talk of. I think what hooked me in with the theater or performance in that capacity more than, because I didn't have like a big part in Prelude to a Kiss. I it's not like everybody at the end was writing up articles about Uncle Fred and yeah. Prelude to a Kiss, but the process of, you know, rehearsing and learning where I'm standing and where I'm entering and meeting different people in the theater. I mean, I was exposed to, you know, new kinds of people that I hadn't met before. And all that was very addicting to me. I was like, well, this is, because I feel like I'm a little bit of an investigator in life anyway. And all of a sudden I had all these new people around me and new experiences to sort of dive into. And I think that's what hooked me.
We'll come to FISBO and obviously the clown aspect, because that's a lot of what people recognize you for with Modern Family and that link. But let's come to the first plot twist question. And we talk about moments in life, unexpected moments that can change our story, our trajectory. What is, for you, Eric, the big plot twist?
Well, I digress a little bit, but it goes to, and we've talked, this person and I have talked about this since, but I was in love with a girl in high school and I went off to Kansas State and she stayed behind and we tried to date back and forth and it didn't work. And she ended up breaking up with me. I got very sad, which is what prompted my best friend Paul to say, hey, you need to shake it up a little bit and tired of you moping around. Let's audition for a play. So that was my first probably plot twist of my life, which was I thought I was going to be a prison administrator, live in Terre Haute, Indiana, drive a minivan, and Christina was going to be my wife and we were going to live happily ever after like that. You know, it's naive to think that looking back, but that was the path that I was on at that point.
And I guess fast forwarding a few years later, Modern Family arrives as this opportunity. That must have been a massive plot twist in that I guess you never know how a show is going to be received and how it's going to take off. And obviously that has just become just a treasure in itself. It's such a warm comfort. It's one of the all-time classic sitcoms now. That must have been a pretty big plot twist moment as well, right?
Well, there's a few plot twists leading up to Modern Family that I would not have been available, meaning emotionally, talent-wise, psychologically ready for the moment when Modern Family presents itself. You know, there's a whole lot of no's, there's a whole lot of maybes, there's a whole lot of ups and downs that lead an actor to be prepared for when a giant door like Modern Family opens to you. So I would say, yes, plot twist there, but about 10 plot twists before that prepared me for that one.
It seems to be the way with performance and particularly with acting that there are these, the realities of that world. I mean, obviously now you're in a position where you have been on that show. You've been a huge success. And I suppose now you can open up different opportunities and you have the luxury of being able to choose more. But I suppose before then it is a case of you having to work your way through and as, you know, you have to be quite resilient, I imagine.
Well, look, I have a very vivid memory of us shooting the pilot of Modern Family and being in the trailer and meeting all these people really for the first time, spending sustained time with them for the first time and hearing what all they had going on in their life professionally. You know, Ed O'Neill is Ed O'Neill. He's got a piece of meat in the crock pot and a beautiful $300 bottle of wine and he's fine, right? He's not thinking about what his next job is. Julie was in second position on something. Ty was in second position on something. And I say this meaning that they had backup jobs. If Modern Family didn't go, they had other opportunities coming. Jesse was workshopping a play on Broadway. Sophia had a holding deal with ABC. The kids all had stuff going on. And I'm sitting there listening to all this thinking that I have a Sears callback next week for a commercial. And that was really what I had going on in my life. And that's not to minimize that. That's just to say that, like, I hadn't had sustained work or the prospect of sustained work for about 13 years as an actor. I had been at that point clicking away at it since 1996. And so I just remember thinking, if this doesn't make it, I'm going to go back to grinding it out like I had. I mean, and all actors are grinding it out. There's just
of course, different versions
of it. It's not to make me the woe is me guy and them the, you know, more fortunate than I am. Everyone, you're always grinding it out until you, you know, realize you're on a show that's going to be on for 11 years. And then you have the comfort of sitting back and taking a breath But I remember the longest I'd ever worked on anything in Los Angeles as a professional actor was 8 days. The longest sustained employment I'd ever had before Modern Family was 8 days, and that was on a Comcast commercial campaign.
That contrast is mad. To think where the story goes, right? That's quite incredible.
Yeah. Well, but those are the things that prepared me for that moment.
Yeah, of course. Seize the day.
Yes.
We'll come back to some Modern Family bits, because obviously it's just, I adore it. So the fan in me is keen to know more. But there's a bit of you're a guy, you like your impromptu fun, and we both like our pranks. And there's something, particularly online, where, I mean, Lindsay's been on the receiving end, your partner. I saw the clip the other day where I think you had put a fake snake in the sort of rubber ring as you were kind of sliding down the Kansas City hills. I love that stuff. Is there a particular prank that stands out? Because I'm somebody that can relate to this.
Well, the pranking, there's all kinds of things you sort of idealize and fantasize about being on a TV show. One of the things that I always, a couple things. Being an actor and going to different studios for all those years, walking on the lot and walking to casting offices, you'd see people scooting around in golf carts. So I always imagine, like, wow, how cool would it be to be on your own show and drive around the Warner Brothers or Fox or Paramount in a golf cart and showing people the studio. That's one of the things. The other thing was the parking spot. Like, I couldn't imagine having a TV show, being on a TV show with your name and just being able to pull up to your parking spot. Like, and that all comes from being on studio lots for years and seeing those things with my own eyes. The third thing was being in an ensemble cast where I got to prank everyone. Like, that was that, I couldn't wait for that moment of, like, I am going to prank everyone. Because I was a prankster as a kid and, love setting stuff up. But I quickly found out, and this isn't a shot at anyone else, that I was the only person with that energy in the cast of Modern Family. No one else wanted to do pranks. And so me doing pranks just would then be bullying other people because no one wanted to retaliate on anything. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to be doing a lot of pranks. Now, I still got my own things in with Jesse in particular, because we obviously worked together the most. But I didn't get to do probably the long-term pranks that I wanted to, because I feel like they just kind of would have just fallen on deaf ears. But, Chris Lloyd and I, one of the creators of the show, we had a thing going back and forth for years that he got me with at the end of the show. One day we were out and it was cold and we had craft service in the street and they were serving chicken pot pie. And I had a delightful bowl of chicken pot pie and he was enjoying his bowl of chicken pot pie. I don't know what started it, but we just chatted about the chicken pot pie and then it became like, how good was that chicken pot pie? Well, at the end of the day, I took a bowl of crusty chicken pot pie and had someone take it to, I believe, his chair and just put it in his chair. And then by the time I got to my trailer to change to go home for the night, that bowl was back in my trailer. And then that began a 10-year exchange of a crusty old bowl of chicken pot pie, to which on the last day of Modern Family, it concluded with his assistant handing me a beautifully wrapped present and opening it up in a cryo-sealed, vacuum-sealed bag that had been frozen for 10 years of the same bowl of chicken pot pie. And we laughed and laughed and laughed. So things like that.
That's amazing.
Those stupid little games you develop with people. He and I also had a pair of terribly ugly Nike tennis shoes that we traded back and forth. That on the second to the last day, I had a grip go up into the top of the soundstage and hooked to a rope. And during a very important scene of the last episode, the Nike shoes just are lowered right into his lap from above. And again, we're talking 4 or 5 years we've been trading these shoes back and forth. Things like that. Very, very fond memories of friendship on the show.
also just the diversity of it, in that you're also doing the physical pranks, but you've also got the digital ones as well. Like the aging process is very enjoyable.
Oh yeah, well that's one I forgot about, that with Jesse that started, and I'll never not do that. I mean, he knows my commitment to the longevity of that. I will not relent in aging Jesse. Did you see the one where I aged him with me dressed as the Santa Claus, even behind me on the box truck? I aged the picture of him on the truck. His reactions are what fuel me, though. And that's what I tell Lindsay all the time, too. It's like, look, if you didn't have great reactions, I wouldn't be searching for those great reactions with whatever I'm up to.
I love that there's this, like I said, this impromptu fun about you. But then I was reading, like, the other day, you're on, I think they were doing a Today Show interview, and people thought you were unwell, but it was like clearly you were playing up to the camera. I was like, oh come on, God. Let's have a bit of fun here.
It's so annoying. It's actually really funny, and I feel for anyone who is actually in pain and needs sympathy and needs empathy and needs help from other people. I'm not one of them. But the guy who works with me here in Kansas City, he got to see this happen in real time, because I'd gone to New York to do these interviews, and I'm on the Today Show, and they have you wave at the camera like for 10 seconds. And then, and it's out
Which
of
order. Awkward, right?
Right. And it's also out of order. It's after you've already done your interview. So your interview's over, then you're going to do that. And then when the audience sees it, they'll say, coming up next, Eric Stone Street. And he's, you know, I'm standing waving at the camera. And, you know, 10 seconds doesn't seem like a long time until you're alone in front of a camera waving. Like, then it seems like an eternity. So they said, hey, Eric, before you leave, can we just get you waving at the camera for 10 seconds? And I'm like, sure. So I wave. Well, then Jenna and Hoda are still talking to me as they're leaving. And I was like, yeah, no, I know. It's great. Yeah. And they're like, no, actually, can you just look at the camera and wave for 10 seconds? I'm like, okay. So I start waving. And then I'm like, oh, this is going to happen again, by the way. I'm going to do this. And then somebody's going to see this and say I'm in pain. So we need to say, this is acting that I'm about to do. And then we need to hit it at the end and say, yes, that was acting that I was about to do. So I'm waving at the camera and I'm like, it hurts so bad. It hurts so bad. acting.
And scene.
Well, and scene. Well, they put that on the air and... So I'm writing here at my house in Kansas City, and all of a sudden I get a text from a very dear friend of mine, someone who is well-known, with heart emojis. And I'm like, well, that's a weird text to get from this person. And I said, what's that about? And he wrote back, I heard you're struggling with something right now and that you're in pain. And I'm like, what? And I'm like literally out in the middle of nowhere smoking a cigar, riding around on my UTV, having a great day. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, I just read something online that you're in pain. Well, I immediately go to Twitter, search my name. And sure enough, I've got all these messages of people saying, I'm so sorry you're struggling right now, Eric. I too am in pain. And I'm like, what is going on? And the guy Darcy, who is as far away from Hollywood as you could ever be, is with me. And he gets to watch this happen in real time, where all these news outlets start picking up this clip from one person who decided that I was in pain, puts this out there, to which I'm like, I mean, this is so disrespectful to people who are in pain. So I felt like I needed to say something, be like, it's just a bit, everyone. And then
I thought it was obvious. I really did. I thought it was quite obvious you were messing around.
Because you're a normal human being with a sense of humor that's not out looking for the worst in every situation. You know, but that's what, you know, that gets us into a whole different conversation. But that's what, where we are in our world right now, where everyone has to just find something where there's nothing. And so then another outlet picks up, oh, Eric was just kidding. But that didn't stop these news outlets from keeping posting this day after day. Just hilarious. And also one of the things that makes me never want to go on TV and do interviews ever again in my life.
Yeah, of course. I get it. I'll move on to another plot twist question. This one is a plot twist person. I guess somebody in your life that has been unexpectedly a source of inspiration. I imagine, Eric, you've had quite a few, but if you could pick out those that come to mind, who might be that sort of plot twist persons, we like to define them?
Well, you know, career-wise, it was somebody that came into my life years and years ago that is a very well-known, intimidating figure in actors' worlds. And his name is Joe Pitka. He's a very famous commercial director. And I didn't realize what an inspiration and how helpful he would be to my career at the time. But he was, because he works in a way that prepared me for, you know, things that I didn't know were coming down the pike. And so he would definitely be one of those people. My first audition experience with him was crazy. You know, my agent called and said, you know, you're reading for Joe Pitka. I'm like, okay, what's that mean? She's like, you don't know who Joe Pitka is. And I said, well, I feel like I've heard the name, but no. She's like, well, he's just very well known. And, you know, it could be a really big deal for your career if he likes you. I'm like, I'm already in the business of hoping people like me. Can you not add more pressure to it?
Exactly.
But that's exactly who Joe was. So I go in and I audition for this American Express Tiger Woods commercial. This is like 1998, maybe.
He's just on the rise, yeah.
And so I go in and I audition for him. And sure enough, he's this, when your listeners, you know, Google him and see him, he is an intimidating guy. And I finish and he goes, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Kansas City. He goes, Kansas City, ugh. And I was like, well, where are you from? He goes, Pittsburgh. And I said, Pittsburgh, ugh. And he kind of just sat up in his chair and leaned in. He goes, what's your deal? Like, you know, and we kind of had this dialogue. And I felt like I either like connected with him or I just pissed him off. I didn't know for sure. And so I left. And a couple hours later, I get a phone call. My agent, she's like, what happened with Joe Pitka? I'm like, I mean, I don't know. I did my audition and we kind of talked afterwards. She's like, well, she had casting call and say that you're not getting this job, but you will work together at some point. I'm like, okay, well, that's awesome. And I'd been in the business long enough to know that that doesn't mean anything. Like for somebody to say that means zero. And sure enough, a few weeks later, I get a phone call that said, you know, you're going to do an IBM commercial with Joe Pitka. And that really was the person who put me on the path to be ready for big auditions, because what he took off the plate for me was desperation, right? Going into a room needing anything. He kept hiring me. He liked me. I wouldn't say we became friends at that point. We've become friends since. But he prepared me in a way that got me ready for big moments and allowed me to go in and only focus on what I needed to focus on, which was doing a good job and not needing anything more than, you know, wanting it, right? I wanted the jobs. I didn't need all of them. So I'm very thankful to him, and he hates that I say this, and he hates that I talk about him, because his shtick, as I say, is that he's this big, tough guy, and he is. But he doesn't like, I don't think, people to acknowledge that he's been very meaningful to a lot of people in my position.
Right. I guess not many people would have been cheeky or snapped back like you did. Maybe that was kind of gave you a bit of an edge in that, you know, you showed a bit of character in that sense that you admired, because perhaps he doesn't get that.
You know, in that moment, I was just being myself. That's gotten me in trouble before. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, I think it's part of the endearment.
Yeah. And let me tell you what that means from his side. Again, because life is a tennis match. We volley back and forth with each other. He took a shot at me. I took a shot back at him. He took a shot at me. I took a shot back at him. And what it tells you is that he's a very secure person. He didn't react in a way of like, who is this actor talking to me this way, right? He's himself. He too is an authentic human being who's confident in his abilities. Because when that goes wrong, typically, it's when probably the person isn't as secure in themselves as they're portraying themselves to be.
He sounds like a good ally to have. We obviously mentioned that big show that you're on, which is a treasure. Of course, I'm talking about Dharma and Greg. No, I'm talking about Modern Family. I don't want to knock Dharma and Greg, actually, because they had quite a few series and it was strong. But, you know, there are levels to this game, right?
Well, that's a big one too, though, because when I moved to Los Angeles, I didn't know anyone in the business. I had one name on a piece of paper and a phone number, and that was a woman named Jillian O'Neill. who was a casting associate for Nikki Valco casting, and they cast Armin Gregg. And when I got to LA, I called Jillian and said, your friend gave me your number in Chicago and said to give you a call when I got to LA, and here I am. And she's like, well, send your resume over and we'll call you in if something comes up. Well, they did. They called me in and I didn't get a call back for like 4 times, and they kept calling me back. And then finally I started getting callbacks and not booking the jobs, but they kept calling me in. And then finally I got called back and went in and met Chuck Lorre and Dottie Dartland, who ran the show. And they gave me that little part on Darma and Greg. That was my first part on TV. And it's a huge moment because I had set myself goals of saying, look, if I can't get a speaking part on a TV show within 2 years, I have to readjust, like, and have to think of like, okay, well, maybe prison administration is the angle for my life. And I was fortunate enough to get that fairly quickly after moving to Los Angeles. And I, you know, Chuck Lorre is a TV legend as well. And he's also one of those guys that when I would see him say, you know, you gave me my first part on TV, he's like, oh, come on, you know, whatever. I'm like, no, it's true. Like, you put me on TV for the first time in my life on a TV show. So I want to acknowledge that. But Jillian O'Neill was a huge, huge person for me in Los Angeles. And we still communicate to this day. Oddly, she was on a flight with me once. Right after Modern Family had shot, I had a DVD copy of the pilot. It hadn't been on TV yet.
Oh, okay.
And I get on the plane, and there she is. And I'm like, Jillian, do you want to watch the pilot? And I have it. And she popped it in her computer and watched it on the flight. And she's like, oh, Eric, your life's going to change. You're like, your life's about to change. And so it was nice to be able to share that moment with her so many years. And then to take it to another level, where I auditioned for Darma and Greg all those times and I didn't get the part, literally is about a 200-yard walk around the corner to where my trailer for Modern Family sat for 11 years.
No.
So the first time I was ever on a studio lot in LA was at Fox Studios, Pico and Motor, auditioning for Darma and Greg, the building with the penguins around them. There's a topiary lady that makes topiaries, and it's known for having penguins outside of it. That's where I walked in, and then 11 years later is when Modern Family happens.
That's incredible. Now, I only said that to try and make you chuckle. But Modern Family, very quickly, 10 years since Cam and Mitch got married. That's pretty...
is it really?
Pretty incredible, right? Yeah. Oh. It'll be 10 years this year, which is... Obviously, it was a big moment, right?
Huge.
You see, you said about one of the most meaningful things about being on that show. Obviously, you have an amazing camaraderie with the crew and your cast members. But actually, the impact of the stories and the feedback you got, are there any particular moments like that that really stand out? Because Cam did entertain and really touch the hearts of many people. Are there any particular moments like that that stand out? Because I know that was a particular joy for you.
Well, there's too many to mention. And that's sort of one of the things that, again, in this world where people find it necessary to tear other things down or whatever, I always go back to the individual moments that I've had with people on the street or in the theater or wherever I'm at, happen to be, and people walk up and say something nice to me. But, you know, as a performer, all I ever wanted to do was make people laugh, right? Putting on my mom's wig when I was 5, you know, dancing around, doing whatever. The beginnings of my performance nature was always just to entertain and make people laugh. I never thought that I would have the opportunity to also educate and open eyes and minds and hearts of people. And Chris and Steve, who created Modern Family, their goal always was first of all, to entertain people. We were never like this, you know, show that was trying to do anything other than give people 22 minutes of joy on a Wednesday night with their families or whoever they sat down and watched the show with. What came along with that as the show went on was this opportunity to open people's minds and hearts and eyes to different types of people. And that was very meaningful to me. And the way I knew it was happening. Again, taking any journalist who wants to sit down and write an article about anything to do with our performances or our characters, or if they were too broad, or if they were this, or if they were that. All I fall back on are individual hundreds and probably thousands of conversations that I've had with people that say the exact opposite of what anyone with a typewriter that wants to sit down and type and say what Modern Family was or wasn't. Mitch and Cam met so much to so many people. And Jesse from the very beginning told me, Eric, we're not going to make everybody happy. You need to get that in your mind because that's not going to happen. And there were people that wrote articles that I was, you know, a character and that I was, you know, stereotypical. And, you know, Chris and Steve did, and myself and Jesse, we were shepherds of that character. We did everything we could to make Cam everything but stereotypical, you know, the clowning, the drumming, the football coaching.
Yeah, whatever, totally.
All the different things that came into the character's life. But as far as individual moments, meaningful moments, Jesse and I were, I think he was on the cover of Out magazine or something. And my friend Tim, who when I referenced that I did a play a little while ago, I met new people, right? Tim was the first gay person I'd ever met in my life that was like said he was gay. Where he was just here at the house 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, still close friends. He was my date to Jesse's party of being on Out magazine. And this guy walked up to me. Jesse was somewhere else. And he said, hey, I just want to share this story with you. I've had my friend, Brian, for years. And I finally told my mom that Brian wasn't just my friend, but he was my boyfriend, my partner, my lover. And her response was, well, who's Mitch and who's Cam? Who I'd met so many years ago in the theater department, who's living his life as a gay man, seeing me in New York City at the Out magazine party and having such a personal story of meaningful impact for his mom. This kid was worried what his mom's reaction was going to be to finally telling her that he's gay. And her reaction, well, who's Mitch and who's Cam? He was just like, and it was so amazing that he got to experience that with me. Because so many times I'm alone. So many times Jesse's alone with people in conversation and no one's witness to them. So we just have to track them, remember them, and hopefully share them. And I'm not journaling every time I have these impactful moments. But I was so thankful Tim was there. And he was like, Stone Street, did you ever in a million years think that that's, you know, an impact you would have in someone's life is making a transition or making a coming out story so easier for someone? I'm like, never in a million years.
Gosh.
And so it's wonderful. Stories like that over and over and over the course of being on Modern Family that are so meaningful to me. I'm so thankful for them, so appreciative that people share them, and made Jesse and I just, and Chris and Steve and everybody feel so great about what it was we did. And that's, we always tried to minimize it. We always tried to say like, no, we're just, you know, we're just actors, you know, having a good time. But when you have those moments with people, you realize that we are more than just actors. We have the opportunity to help in situations.
Yeah, that's truly wonderful. I appreciate you sharing that. The last point I wanted to come to was we spoke about the luxury of being on a show and the opportunity, I suppose, that gives you now as an actor and where you can go and what you can do. What are you looking to next? What are the ambitions? Do you still harbor any goals? What's on your mind for the future?
It's a blessing and a curse because, you know, we all, when we're together, talk about what a utopia we had there. You know, it was truly a unique, one-of-a-kind situation with the quality of the work, the quality of the writing, the quality of the people around us. You know, we're not a show that ever had drama. We never had people not coming out of their trailers or infighting on set. None of that ever took place. And so when you start to imagine being on another show or going and working with a whole new group of people, those things scare you. But the pandemic happened right as we were ending. My dad's health declined right as the show was ending. And so my life kind of, I picked up my life and kind of moved it from Los Angeles to Kansas City. And so I've been here, you know, since the show ended, essentially, and been sort of out of Hollywood, dipped my toes back in for a couple little things and whatnot. But I think I'm to the point now where I am interested and I am listening to see what people are interested in seeing me in. I want to hear that. For so many years before Modern Family, I was trying to convince people I could do this. Well, I'd like to have people come to me and say, I'd love to see you do this. And so that's what's happening now. I have a couple irons in the fire to sort of see where that might lead me. But TV's changed also. Like, we were kind of the last show of linear television. You know, there's been a few shows that have come on now that make me think that maybe TV's going to have a comeback, but everybody else is, you know, streams and platforms are different. But I've never done a multi-cam sitcom, like a traditional sitcom where you rehearse it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, shoot it Thursday in front of a live studio audience. That's kind of intriguing to me. That sounds fun, but we'll just see what happens. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. Got to do something.
Any casting directors out there? He's ready, people. He's ready.
Yeah. I'd love to. You know, I just remembered another story when I was in London. I was at, am I going to say it right? Trafalgar Square. And
yeah.
Person walks up to me and says, are you, and this is, again, you have to understand, I'm living this, but I'm also experiencing this, which was a goal of mine with like fame or notoriety, was to be it, but also like enjoy it and watch it happen. And there I am in Trafalgar Square and a person walks up to me and says, are you? And I'm like, how are you? They're like, great. And it was a person in London who was from Qatar, but lived in like Jordan or somewhere else, who wanted to just come up and say how much they liked the show. And I just, my mind was blown, because in that moment, I'm in another country. Someone from another country who lives in another country,
right,
knew who I was. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. But yeah, I would love to do something in England, because
we'd love to have you.
My mom has always been a longtime fan of all of the shows. She's no doubt, some of my sense of humor was as a kid was carved by some of the great English comedians. And so I would love to do something there. I always thought it'd be fun to do some sort of detective show on the BBC. I would love that. Just a classic English detective show where I'm solving crimes.
I'd love that.
Yeah.
I'd love that. The other one was actually doing a kind of behind the scenes documentary with the Chiefs, with you kind of leading that. I thought that would be, whether it's kind of in character as Randy Reid or actually just more generally behind the scenes as a fan, I thought that'd be pretty cool. I'd love to watch that.
I love, because again, I don't lack the opportunity of realizing how lucky and fortunate I am. So I do love going places that I get to go because of me, but in the spirit of doing it for everyone else and living that life on behalf of Kansas City Chiefs fans or whatever I might be talking about fans, because that's at the end of the day, like, I am just a guy who enjoys life and things. And I would love to be able to have other people experience them through me.
We'd love to watch it. A massive thank you for coming on the show. It's a real personal joy. I can't express that enough. Yeah, best of luck with everything going forwards. Best of health to you and to Lindsay. And hopefully one day I can meet you in person. That would be a real joy.
Yeah, well, you can be the murder victim whose crime I'm trying to solve in the UK.
I'll just be the body laying there.
The acting though, not in real life. Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, you can be the corpse.
Tomorrow and in 2 weeks' time, is there a prediction? If I had to push you?
Oh, you mean the game?
Yeah.
I don't bet against Patrick Mahomes. I mean, I think if we win, I think it'll be a 23-20, 27-24 victory. But I'm always willing to say my Kansas City Chiefs are going to win. I never used to think that. And that's what Patrick Mahomes has done, is he's made me believe there's always a chance. So, of course, I believe there's a chance. And let's go for it. I think we're going to win.
Championship DNA. I'd like to see them against the Lions, just because of like Lions never being there before. Yeah. I think there's a nice sort of story there. That'd be quite cool.
It'd be great.
Thank you, Eric.
Oh, you got it. Thank you.
Well, he got that prediction right. And you know, if my acting debut is the corpse that Eric Stonestreet finds in a new BBC or Sky limited series, I'm ready for it. I'm ready. A big thank you to him. That was such a joy. You know, when you get to speak to these people that you've watched on screen and enjoyed watching over a number of years and have a chat about their life and career like that, it's such a thrill. A big, big thank you to Eric Stonestreet. What an interesting life. I mean, even going back to fourth grade, I mean, to look after 60 pigs and the learnings he said he got from that, you know, thinking beyond the 3 feet around you and not being self-consumed and thinking about others, essentially. And even being integrated into that Kansas City environment, thinking, oh, I'll be a prison administrator. And of course, fast forward a few years and finds acting and it develops from there. And even the plot twist person was interesting in Joe Pitka, that, you know, this intimidating person, but Eric stayed true to who he was. He's fun. He's got a bit of wit. And he also just happens to be a pretty damn good actor. So that probably helped. But it took away an element of desperation. And maybe in the audition process, that must help, right? We obviously spoke about Modern Family. I loved the conversation about the pranking. 10 years with the chicken pot pie. I didn't know about that, but that was a lot of fun. Even just the stories of like meeting people, like his friend Tim and his mum's reaction to this big news in almost nonchalant terms, like, well, who's Cameron, who's Mitch? Like, she watched the show and there was this understanding that made the whole thing so much easier. I just thought there was something really lovely about that. What a joy that was. Big thank you to Eric Stonestreet. If you want more of him, Secret Life of Pets, first film is on Sky and now, good one for Easter with the kids. And you know what? If you've got your Sky remote, just say Modern Family. And if you've got Disney Plus, you can watch all of it. Go and enjoy it. Now, from one American to another, third week running, another American next week. The singing sensation from Atlanta, Georgia, Teddy Swims. I'm such a fan of this guy. I have been for a number of years. He blew up on YouTube, had an album out last year, lead single, Lose Control. It's an amazing song. He's coming to the UK doing a bit of a tour, so we're going to talk to him about that and his own plot twist. I cannot wait. So until then, ciao, guys.